Chapter 50. The games, the great dance was not to begin until 8 o'clock, but for any lads and lasses who liked to dance on the shady grass before then, there was music always at hand, for was not the band of the Benefit Club capable of playing excellent jigs, reels, and hornpipes? And, besides this, there was a grand band hired from Rossiter, who, with their wonderful wind instruments and puffed-out cheeks, were themselves a delightful show to the small boys and girls. To say nothing of Joshua Rand's fiddle, which, by an act of generous forethought, he had provided himself with, in case anyone should be of sufficiently pure taste to prefer dancing to a solo on that instrument. Meantime, when the sun had moved off the great open space in front of the house, the games began. There were, of course, well-soaked poles to be climbed by the boys and youths, races to be run by the old women, races to be run in sacks, heavy weights to be lifted by the strong men, and a long list of challenges to such ambitious attempts as that of walking as many yards possible on one leg, feats in which it was generally remarked that Wiry Ben, being the lissomest, springest fellow I the country, was sure to be preeminent. To crown all, there was to be a donkey race, that sublimest of all races, conducted on the grand socialistic idea of everybody encouraging everybody else's donkey, and the sorriest donkey winning. And soon after 4 o'clock, splendid old Mrs. Irwin, in her damask satin and jewels and black lace, was led out by Arthur, followed by the whole family party, to her raised seat under the striped marquee, where she was to give out the prizes to the victors. Staid, formal Miss Lydia had requested to resign that queenly office to the royal old lady, and Arthur was pleased with this opportunity of gratifying his godmother's taste for stateliness. Old Mr. Donathern, the delicately clean, finely scented, withered old man, led out Miss Irwin, with his air of punctilious, acid politeness. Mr. Gawain brought Miss Lydia, looking neutral and stiff in an elegant peach blossom silk, and Mr. Irwin came last with his pale sister Anne. No other friend of the family, besides Mr. Gawain, was invited today. There was to be a grand dinner for the neighboring gentry on the morrow, but today all the forces were required for the entertainment of the tenants. There was a sunk fence in front of the marquee, dividing the lawn from the park, but a temporary bridge had been made for the passage of the victors, and the groups of people standing, or seated here and there on benches, stretched on each side of the open space from the white marquees up to the sunk fence. "Upon my word, it's a pretty sight," said the old lady, in her deep voice, when she was seated, and looked round on the bright scene with its dark green background. "And it's the last fete day I'm likely to see, unless you make haste and get married, Arthur. But take care you get a charming bride, else I would rather die without seeing her." "You're so terribly fastidious, godmother," said Arthur, "I'm afraid I should never satisfy you with my choice." "Well, I won't forgive you, if she's not handsome. I can't be put off with amiability, which is always the excuse people are making for the existence of plain people. And she must not be silly, that will never do, because you'll want managing, and a silly woman can't manage you. Who is that tall young man, Dofe, with the mild face? There, standing without his hat, and taking such care of that tall old woman by the side of him, his mother, of course. I like to see that." "What, don't you know him, mother?" said Mr. Irwin. "Had a Seth Bede, Adam's brother, a Methodist, but a very good fellow. Poor Seth has looked rather downhearted of late. I thought it was because of his father's dying in that sad way, but Joshua Rand tells me he wanted to marry that sweet little Methodist preacher who was here about a month ago, and I suppose she refused him." "Ah, I remember hearing about her. But there are no end of people here that I don't know, for they're grown up and altered so, since I used to go about." "What excellent sight you have," said old Mr. Donathern, who was holding a double glass up to his eyes, "to see the expression of that young man's face so far off. His face is nothing but a pale blurred spot to me. But I fancy I have the advantage of you, when we come to look close. I can read small print without spectacles. Ah, my dear sir, you began with being very nearsighted, and those nearsighted eyes always wear the best. I want very strong spectacles to read with, but then I think my eyes get better and better for things at a distance. I suppose if I could live another 50 years, I should be blind to everything that wasn't out of other people's sight, like a man who stands in a well and sees nothing but the stars. See, said Arthur, the old women are ready to set out on their race now. Which do you bet on, Gawain? The long-legged one, unless they're going to have several heats, and then the little wiry one may win. There are the Poysers, mother, not far off on the right hand, said Miss Irwin. Mrs. Poyser is looking at you. Do take notice of her. To be sure I will, said the old lady, giving a gracious bow to Mrs. Poyser. Woman who sends me such excellent cream cheese is not to be neglected. Bless me! What a fat child that is she is holding on her knee! But who is that pretty girl with dark eyes? That is Hetty Sorrel, said Miss Lydia Donathorne, Martin Poyser's niece, a very likely young person, and well-looking too. My maid has taught her fine needlework, and as he has mended some lace of mine very respectably, indeed very respectably. Why, as he has lived with the Poysers 6 or 7 years, mother, you must have seen her, said Miss Irwin. No, I've never seen her, child, at least not as she is now, said Mrs. Irwin, continuing to look at Hetty. Ill-looking, indeed. She's a perfect beauty. I've never seen anything so pretty since my young days. What a pity such beauty as that should be thrown away among the farmers, when it's wanted so terribly among the good families without fortune. I dare say, now, she'll marry a man who would have thought her just as pretty, if as he had had round eyes and red hair. Arthur dared not turn his eyes towards Hetty, while Mrs. Irwin was speaking of her. He feigned not to hear, and to be occupied with something on the opposite side. But he saw her plainly enough without looking. Saw her in heightened beauty, because he heard her beauty praised for other men's opinion, you know, was like a native climate to Arthur's feelings. It was the air on which they thrived the best, and grew strong. Yes. She was enough to turn any man's head. Any man in his place would have done, and felt the same. And to give her up after all, as he was determined to do, would be an act that he should always look back upon with pride. No, mother, and Mr. Irwin, replying to her last words, I can't agree with you there. The common people are not quite so stupid as you imagine. The commonest man, who has his ounce of sense and feeling, is conscious of the difference between a lovely, delicate woman and a coarse one. Even a dog feels a difference in their presence. The man may be no better able than the dog to explain the influence the more refined beauty has on him, but he feels it. Bless me, Dofa, what does an old bachelor like you know about it? Oh, that is one of the matters in which old bachelors are wiser than married men, because they have time for more general contemplation. Your fine critic of woman must never shackle his judgment by calling one woman his own. But, as an example of what I was saying, that pretty Methodist preacher I mentioned just now told me that as he had preached to the roughest miners, and had never been treated with anything but the utmost respect and kindness by them. The reason is, though she doesn't know it, that there's so much tenderness, refinement, and purity about her. Such a woman as that brings with her airs from heaven, that the coarsest fellow is not insensible to. Here's a delicate bit of womanhood, or girlhood, coming to receive a prize, I suppose, said Mr. Gawain. He must be one of the racers in the sacks, who had set off before we came. The bit of womanhood was our old acquaintance Bessie Cranage, otherwise Chad's Bess, whose large red cheeks and glossy person had undergone an exaggeration of color, which, if as he had happened to be a heavenly body, would have made her sublime. Bessie, I am sorry to say, had taken to her earrings again since Dinah's departure, and was otherwise decked out in such small finery as she could muster. Anyone who could have looked into poor Bessie's heart would have seen a striking resemblance between her little hopes and anxieties and Hetty's. The advantage, perhaps, would have been on Bessie's side in the matter of feeling. But then, you see, they were so very different outside. He would have been inclined to box Bessie's ears, and he would have longed to kiss Eddie. Bessie had been tempted to run the arduous race, partly from mere hedonish gaiety, partly because of the prize. Someone had said there were to be cloaks, and other nice clothes for prizes, and she approached the Marquis, fanning herself with her handkerchief, but with exultation sparkling in her round eyes. "Here is the prize for the first sack race," said Miss Lydia, taking a large parcel from the table, where the prizes were laid, and giving it to Mrs. Irwin before Bessie came up, an excellent program gown and a piece of flannel. "You didn't think the winner was to be so young, I suppose, aunt?" said Arthur. "Old, you find something else for this girl, and save that grim-looking gown for one of the older women?" "I have bought nothing but what is useful and substantial," said Miss Lydia, adjusting her own lace. "I should not think of encouraging a love of finery in young women of that class. I have a scarlet cloak, but that is for the old woman who wins." This speech of Miss Lydia's produced rather a mocking expression in Mrs. Irwin's face as she looked at Arthur, while Bessie came up and dropped a series of curtsies. "This is Bessie Cranage, mother," said Mr. Irwin, kindly, "Chad Cranage's daughter. You remember Chad Cranage, the blacksmith?" "Yes, to be sure," said Mrs. Irwin. "Well, Bessie, here is your prize, excellent warm things for winter. I'm sure you have had hard work to win them this warm day." Bessie's lip fell as she saw the ugly heavy gown which felt so hot and disagreeable to, on this July day, and was such a great ugly thing to carry. She dropped her curtsies again, without looking up, and with a growing tremulousness about the corners of her mouth, and then turned away. "Poor girl," said Arthur, "I think she's disappointed. I wish it had been something more to her taste." "She's a bold-looking young person," observed Miss Lydia. "Odd at all one I should like to encourage." Arthur silently resolved that he would make Bessie a present of money before the day was over, that she might buy something more to her mind. But she, not aware of the consolation in store for her, turned out of the open space, where she was visible from the Marquis, and throwing down the odious bundle under a tree, began to cry very much, tittered at the while by the small boys. In this situation she was descried by her discreet matronly cousin, who lost no time in coming up, having just given the baby into her husband's charge. "What's the matter, why ye?" said Bess the matron, taking up the bundle and examining it. "And Swelter Dewerson, I reckon, running that fool's race. And here, thank Guyon you lot so good program and flannel, as should Hobbin Guyon by good rights to them as had the sense to keep away from such foolery. He might spare me a bit o' this program, to make clothes for the lad he wore ne'er ill-natured, Bess. I never set that on ye. Ye may take it all, for what I care," said Bess the maiden, with a pettish movement, beginning to wipe away her tears and recover herself. "Well, I could do wit, if so be ye want to get rid on't," said the disinterested cousin, walking quickly away with the bundle, lest Chad's Bess should change her mind. But that bonny-cheeked lass was blessed with an elasticity of spirits that secured her from any rankling grief, and by the time the grand climax of the donkey race came on, her disappointment was entirely lost in the delightful excitement of attempting to stimulate the last donkey by hisses, while the boys applied the argument of sticks. But the strength of the donkey mind lies in adopting a course inversely as the argument surged, which, well considered, requires as great a mental force as the direct sequence. And the present donkey proved the first-rate order of his intelligence by coming to a dead standstill just when the blows were thickest. Great was the shouting of the crowd, radiant the grinning of Bill Downs the stone sawyer, and the fortunate rider of this superior beast, which stood calm and stiff-legged in the midst of its triumph. Arthur himself had provided the prizes for the men, and Bill was made happy with a splendid pocket knife, supplied with blades and gimlets enough to make a man at home on a desert island. He had hardly returned from the marquee with the prize in his hand, when it began to be understood that Wiry Ben proposed to amuse the company before the gentry went to dinner with an impromptu and gratuitous performance, namely, a hornpipe, the main idea of which was doubtless borrowed. But this was to be developed by the dancer in so peculiar and complex a manner that no one could deny him the praise of originality. Wiry Ben's pride in his dancing and accomplishment, productive of great effect at the yearly wake, had needed only slightly elevating by an extra quantity of good ale to convince him that the gentry would be very much struck with his performance of his hornpipe. And he had been decidedly encouraged in this idea by Joshua Rann, who observed that it was nothing but right to do something to please the young squire in return for what he had done for them. You will be the less surprised at this opinion in so grave a personage when you learn that Ben had requested Mr. Rann to accompany him on the fiddle, and Joshua felt quite sure that though there might not be much in the dancing, the music would make up for it. Adam Bede, who was present in one of the large marquees where the plan was being discussed, told Ben he had better not make a fool of himself, a remark which at once fixed Ben's determination. He was not going to let anything alone, because Adam Bede turned up his nose at it. "What's this? What's this?" said old Mr. Donathorne. "Is it something you've arranged, Arthur? Here's the clerk coming with his fiddle, and a smart fellow with a nosegay in his buttonhole." "No," said Arthur, "I know nothing about it. By Jove, he's going to dance. It's one of the carpenters, I forget his name at this moment." "It's Ben Cranage, Wiry Ben, they call him," said Mr. Irwin. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.